This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Hear from a national leader in African-American mentoring during a Twin Cities visit.
Black people will progress by the ballot, the buck, and the book. So you got to vote. You got to understand and embrace entrepreneurship. And you got to understand the importance of education.
Thomas Dorch Jr. is the chairman of the 100 Black Men of America. Plus, you'll hear from the new Bloomington police chief and go back in time with McHistory, featuring a would-have-been Hall of Fame pitcher from Bloomington, Jack Powell. All that after a GLT news update. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. A national leader in African-American mentorship is bringing his message to Bloomington Normal. Thomas Dorch Jr. is the chairman of 100 Black Men of America. The mentoring group with extensive ties to State Farm has an active chapter in Bloomington Normal. Dorch was the keynote speaker at the recent 100 Black Men Excellence Gala in Bloomington. He spoke to WGLT student reporter Tiffany Jackson about the importance of solidarity and pushing back against what he calls Willie Lynch syndrome, a reference to a slave owner who famously spoke in the 1700s about controlling black slaves by setting them against one another.
It pitted the older men against the younger men. It pitted women against men and men against women, the light complexion black people against the dark complexion black people. Unity is it. If we're going to make it in this country, I have a strong faith. God created us all, and so we're born for a reason the way we are. But the issue is, if we're going to progress as black people, we got to be unified. Late Maynard Jackson said that black people will progress by the ballot, the buck, and the book. So you got to vote, you got to understand and embrace entrepreneurship, and you got to understand the importance of education. So what we've tried to do from our first chapter in 1963, the way we got our name, and you may have mentioned, in 1963 in New York City, black police officers could not arrest white citizens if they broke the law. They had to have accompanied with them a white police officer. And on this particular day in 1963, the black police officer arrested a white citizen, and they had all this uproar. So the late Jackie Robinson, David Dinkins, former mayor of New York, all of them came together and they changed the paradigm in that city and changed the way law enforcement operated. And from that, they took on other issues. And later in that year, they said, what shall we call ourselves? They decided they were going to stay together. And David Dinkins is the one who came up with our name. He said, we'll call ourselves who we are, 100 Black Men. And so today, with almost 8,000 members, 101 chapters, over 125,000 young people in the organization, we're still growing strong. And our motto is, we are real men given real time. And so that's why we're moving now, and you're right. In this country, black men and black women have got to come together. There's no reason for us to be apart. And what we're trying to do is get our folks to understand the strength in numbers. And so that's where we are. And that's why, again, for us, black men, because the white community and others tried to depict us as being people who didn't take care of their family and weren't there. In every community, you got Jewish men that don't take care of their family. You got white men that don't take care of their family. You got Hispanic men. So you don't define us as a whole by some. And so what we've been trying to do is say, okay, here we are, black men, standing for our family, making a difference.
As an African-American man, why do you believe having a mentor is important as a young adult?
Well, mentors are trusted advisors. They're givers of good information and sharing of knowledge. Mentoring works. You see, I'm 69 years old. I was born in 1950. And back then, they didn't call it mentoring. But in my community, the elders were always there for us. We have a tour now I've started called The Barbershop. When I wrote my book, called The Miracles of Mentoring. One of the things that I put in there was about the barbershop. Growing up in a small segregated town, when all of us young people went to the barbershop, we got a cut out of life because these elders knew who we were, and they would always question whether we were, how are we doing in school, and we're staying out of trouble. But it's important for us to continue that because none of us got to where we are by ourselves. I own 6 businesses, over 700 employees. I'm in multiple states. My father was an entrepreneur, and I never thought I'd make as much money as my father. My first job, I made more money than my teachers, and that wasn't right. I mean, teachers, I wouldn't be where I am if it weren't for teachers. But as a result of that, I own my 6 businesses. I've made a little bit of change, north of $100 million plus. But I realize now, and I tell all young people, you'll never be paid what you're worth working for somebody else. That's not to say go out and quit your job, but start to work and create a job. I walked away from a pretty big paying job to start my own businesses. I found out after 22 years of public service, I worked for Jimmy Carter when he was governor. I worked for George Busby as governor. I worked for U.S. Senator Sam Nunn. I was the first African-American state director for any U.S. senator. And I had power, influence, and was enjoying it, but I wasn't making the money I knew I could make. And so today, I do well. I create jobs. I believe in creating wealth, helping others to create wealth. And so it's important that we embrace and understand entrepreneurship. We understand that, again, we can stay on a J-O-B and that drug they call a paycheck, or you can have multiple streams of income. I'm in parking. I've done with my parking somewhere in the neighborhood about $60 million. I'm in transportation. That one's been a cash cow. And I have a mattress manufacturing company. I have 2 consulting firms, one for the public sector, one for the private sector. And then I also have an investment group. But all of those, again, the key, again, is I pay my employees. But they have to also understand that all smart people don't earn PhDs. You hire them. You got to hire good people and know how to work it. But for us, it's important for us to embrace and understand, again, we've got to create opportunities for that next generation. And we earn over $1.2 trillion a year. And then when we look at our brown brothers and sisters, they're now doing about $1.4 trillion. Our money out of the American economy, and it goes totally bankrupt. And so we have to deal from a position of strength. And we've got to, just as we've got to come together as black people and look at how we build our community, we've got to come together economically. You know, for my businesses, first, majority of my vendors are African-American. If I don't give them a chance, if I don't use them, how can I complain about what white folks don't do? And so we have to also understand and trust. I mean, black people get angry. They go to a black business and have a bad experience. They say, I'm not going back. Well, we've been getting the bad experiences from so many different white folks for so many years, but they still go back. And so it's about us understanding and working together, because it's not about black and white. It's about service and people who understand. And the last thing on that I tell people, there's no such thing as a black business. It may be a black-owned, African-American-owned business, but the same principles that Coca-Cola and UPS and Walmart, that they use, we have to use the same principle. Good employees, you got to have customer service, you got to be financed. And so once we begin to understand that, and we control our resources, it's like your campus. You look at what you buy, and I'm sure the majority of people you go to don't look like you. Why don't you, like you started your paper? That's what you have to do, is start your own way. So that's important.
Where do you see this organization going within the next 5 or 10 years? What's your goals for it?
Well, right now, I'm looking at more international expansion. I have an interest group in Ghana. I have an interest group in Kenya. I was with the oil minister of Nigeria back about 2 months ago. We're going into Nigeria. We're about to look at South Africa. When President Mandela was released from prison, the first public appearance he did in the U.S. was for the 100 Black Men of Atlanta. We had him in the stadium at Georgia Tech. 54,000 people turned out. And so I just turned down last year to be the honorary consul general for South Africa. I just didn't have the time, but I stayed close and worked with South Africa. So we're looking there, and then we're looking in areas where I don't have chapters, because wherever there are young men and women, black men and women, they need positive male role models in their lives. Young black boys need positive female role models. Young ladies need positive male role models. They don't need to think that all men are bad and all black men are bad. So we're going to expand a little bit more. We're now moving from our dollars and cents program that we do with State Farm to funding and financing those business plans to put people in the business. And, you know, I've invested in a lot of startups. I've lost money and I made money. But it's just like, you know, I lost a ton of money on Wall Street. I made money. So you just got to be focused and try and help create more jobs and more wealth.
It's Thomas Dortch Jr., chairman of the 100 Black Men of America organization, speaking with WGLT student reporter Tiffany Jackson. Dortch was a keynote speaker at last weekend's 100 Black Men Excellence Gala in Bloomington. This is Sound Ideas. There's a big difference in small business lending to white companies and those run by people of color. A recent report made that point. Maureen McKinney looked at the consequences.
Champagne entrepreneur Jemiah Beard faced a pair of unattractive options to fulfill her largest contracts to date. She had a choice: give up the $100,000 or more, or deal with the embarrassment of asking her business community members for help to float her payroll.
It was kind of to a point where I was like, I'm not going to get any money, and I was like literally wanted to terminate my contract.
She got the loan needed to hire workers and buy equipment, finally, with the help of the Illinois Black Chamber of Commerce. The African-American woman says she believes the difficulty in getting capital from Mary's Master Cleaning Services came down to her race.
There needs to be some type of change in the system and the policy as to where it can help us, not build another barrier for us to not be able to prosper or move forward.
She's not alone. A recent report by the Woodstock Institute of Chicago found that banks in Illinois are much more likely to lend to white-owned businesses as opposed to their minority counterparts. Woodstock is a nonprofit research and policy organization that works in the areas of fair lending, wealth creation, and financial systems reform. The report found if the disparity between white and non-white communities could be corrected in Illinois, predominantly minority census tracts would have gotten 19,000 more loans over a three-year period. Brent Adams is co-author of the report, which recommends a federal investigation.
Our system is structured whereby if you do well and have a lot of money, you're more able to do well and have a lot of money. The degree to which there exists a racial wealth gap, that perpetuates itself unless something is done affirmatively to fix it.
Marcus Pickett, who is African-American, started his business, Temperature Doctors Heating and Cooling, in Rockford 13 years ago. He says his credit and business records are excellent. Nevertheless, he's had so much trouble getting loans that he's had to use credit cards or to share jobs with other contractors. Both have limited his earning potential.
It was always some excuse, you know, even sometimes before the application process started. They wouldn't even look at our application. They wouldn't look at our ask.
He says one bank told him outright that they didn't want to lend him the money because they didn't think his business could make it. Adam says the shortage of businesses in minority communities hurts those neighborhoods. They may not have access to fresh food or mainstream financial services, instead turning to payday lenders.
Small businesses create jobs. They are the biggest job creator in our economy. And so those local jobs are also not available. And so that's going to lead to a whole host of problems that's going to have a ripple effect throughout an entire neighborhood.
Ben Jackson is the vice president at the Illinois Bankers Association. He says the banking industry takes matters related to fair lending and discrimination seriously and wants to contribute to the independent research on disparities.
I think the report kind of understates the billions of dollars in voluminous resources that banks provide through nonprofit lending partners, including community development, financial institutions, community lenders, and small business resource centers on a continual basis. And again, our industry is constantly seeking to innovate its approaches to reaching underserved consumers and small business owners.
It doesn't feel that way to Pickett.
I know what this market can bear. I know what my competition is, and I know where I need to be in my overhead to stay in business. It's not something that I'm guessing at, and I have a business plan to prove it. And you turn me down based on what? The fact that you don't think I'm going to make it, and I'm a risk to the bank because of my skin color, and that's just it's not right. We have to be twice as good to make it. That needs to change, not just for me and myself, and I'm not here to complain. I'm going to do what I got to do to make it. But again, there's a difference between thriving and surviving.
I'm Maureen McKinney.
After a break, you'll hear from Bloomington's new police chief. This is Sound Ideas.
WGLT is a service of Illinois State University. Illinois State is consistently ranked among the top universities nationwide by U.S. News & World Report, which cites Illinois State's academic quality and excellence. More at illinoisstate.edu/pointsofpride. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Bloomington City Manager Tim Gleason has chosen the internal candidate to lead the police department. WGLT's Eric Stock reports how Dan Doneth became the new police chief and what he plans to do to improve community relations and his officers' own health.
Bloomington City Manager Tim Gleason made the announcement during a City Hall news conference.
I'd like to recognize Bloomington's new police chief, Dan Doneth.
The 50-year-old Doneth joined BPD in 1994 and most recently served as assistant chief. He shared interim chief duties during the search process for a new chief. Former Chief Clay Wheeler retired in June. Doneth emerged from among over 60 applicants who were vetted by a search committee of city and community leaders. The other finalist was Parkland College Police Chief William Colebrook, a retired Illinois State Police captain who began his law enforcement career in Pontiac. Gleason calls Doneth the obvious choice. He says a trait he consistently heard from coworkers and others who worked with Doneth was high character.
You get the feeling that he has sympathy, empathy. He's a man of integrity and of his word. So when he communicates, I think he is trusted, and that's critical when we're talking about trying to improve a relationship with the community.
Doneth admits he was a little surprised when he found out that he was chosen.
It's hard to absorb and think about that, you know, when I started my career 25 and a half years ago, that I would be in this position because it wasn't my goal. My goal was just to come in and work hard and do a good job and try to make a difference. And that approach has just led me to this position.
Doneth says he plans to conduct a full review of all department policies and procedures to see what can be improved.
If I was to, you know, like say give a numerical rating to our police department, I'd say it's an 85 overall. And my goal would to make that to be a 90 or a 95. So there's always room for improvement. We do a ton of great stuff, as reflected by the low crime in our community and the experiences that our citizens have here.
Bloomington has seen a drop in serious crimes in each of the last 5 years. That's often overshadowed by the problem of gun violence. Last year was the deadliest in recent history in Bloomington Normal. When asked how he might differ from the status quo, Doneth said he would like to expand the department's community policing efforts.
There's some things I'd like to do. I'd like to work on our community policing aspect a little bit. I've got, you know, a different view of that, or not a different view, but an expanded view of that.
City Manager Tim Gleason says he doesn't see much that needs to be changed in the department. Gleason says he typically wants to promote internally if possible, but that is not why Doneth got the job.
This is one of those positions within a community that it's critical that you get it right. So I was not locked into, no favoritism to an internal candidate at all.
Doneth says he considers himself open-minded and prefers face-to-face communication, traits he says will help him foster strong relations with the public.
I'm not a big, let's say, email person because a lot can be lost in a translation of an email. I like to talk to people and understand, you know, where they're coming from and what their perspective is.
Donath deflects a question about his opinion of public perception of the police department. He says the only way he can quantify that is through social media engagement.
We get a lot of support from the community. When we put stuff out on social media, maybe asking for some help on something, we get a great response. So my general feeling is that, and even people that I'm around and I talk to, you know, they seem to have a pretty good feeling.
The city of Bloomington created a group 2 years ago to improve relations between police and the public. The Public Safety and Community Relations Board has fielded a few complaints about officer conduct. Chairman Art Taylor served on the Police Chief Search Committee.
We've got a running relationship with him, so there's a great deal of familiarity there. And I look forward to him as chief and what he'll be able to bring to the community and the voice that he'll be able to share with all of us.
Donath has served as a police liaison with the PSCRB. Taylor cheers his call for bolstered community policing.
The ways of policing in the past are just that, the past. And the police have to have a presence in the community and listen to what the community is talking about. There are segments of the community that don't always feel that positive about the police.
City Manager Gleason not only leaned on a 5-member committee to help with the chief's search, he also used his own background as a police officer in Pekin to see who would fit. He says Donath understands the need for a front-facing police force.
He knows that we're at a point in policing that we cannot engage with the community enough. We can't tell our story enough. We can't support our officers. I mean, this is a tough job.
Donath says he, too, is concerned about his officers' health. He would like to expand the department's wellness program. He says BPD has already tried to improve physical wellness by promoting workout routines and healthy diets, but he wants to add programs that address mental and financial well-being. Donath says officers face a physically and mentally demanding job, especially since now they have to work until 55 to collect a pension.
We're under the microscope. Everybody's watching. You got certain people that like to play the gotcha games. So it's a very stressful environment. So I see these two things going on, that you're going to have to work longer, but you're going to have to work in a more stressful environment. And that's not good for a human being, for any of us.
Donath says he's not sure what new wellness efforts might include. He's open to meditation and yoga, something other police departments have done. Donath says he's already reached out to counseling services in the community, though he adds the financial programs won't likely start until next year.
Any human being can find themselves where they don't take care of their money or they don't plan for the future and stuff like that, and then you find yourself in a position where that creates stress in your life. I'm trying to de-stress officers' lives as best I can because the job itself already creates a ton of stress.
But despite the difficulty of the job, Donath decided long ago a life in law enforcement was the correct path for him. After college at Illinois State University, he worked as an insurance claims adjuster in Rockford. He says that helped lay the groundwork for his next career as a cop.
So I met with everybody, which was also part of the thing that helped me out, was that I can talk to anybody. I don't treat anybody differently. It doesn't matter who you are. I'll listen to you. And then, you know, some people you get a lot from and some people you don't get as much from. But everybody's got a perspective and what they're looking for.
Donath says he eventually realized he did not want a career in insurance. He decided a life of public service was his calling.
I felt like there was good opportunity and to continue just really helping people. You know, when you're in the insurance world, you know, you've got one aspect of it, but when you're in police work, now you have a different aspect of how you can help people. And so really that was the biggest thing.
Donath will be paid $151,000. That's slightly less than his predecessor, Clay Wheeler's salary of nearly $156,000. I'm Eric Stock.
Donath assumed the duties of police chief following a private ceremony yesterday. There'll be a public swearing-in ceremony on September 9th. Coming up later in the show, a new episode of WGLT's McHistory series. This is Sound Ideas. Four 4 years ago today, Dolores French was found dead in her unit at the Quincy Veterans Home. She's one of 14 residents who died following repeated outbreaks of Legionnaires' disease at the state-run facility. 12 families are suing the state for negligence. Now, for the first time, Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul has offered to settle several of those lawsuits. Some families say Raoul's initial settlement offers are so low they're insulting. Dave McKinney and Tony Arnold have the story. Dave starts things off.
During the four Legionnaires outbreaks that have hit the Quincy Veterans Home, the death of 78-year-old Dolores French is one of the most egregious. Before her death, her family said she had been in good health. Then in 2015, she was reported missing for 2 days. Staff ultimately found her body in her own room. She'd been dead for 48 hours. Her son, Steve French, sued the state for neglecting his mom, and he's still waiting for resolution.
It's been 4 years. It just doesn't, it seems unconscionable that anybody that has the ability to do something would allow it to keep on lingering on.
Steve had hoped his lawsuit against the state would have been done by now.
But for 3 years, the state has fought the dozen families' lawsuits and has denied responsibility for the Legionnaires' deaths. Attorney General Kwame Raoul finally offered to pay some of the families and settle their cases. However, several families tell WBEZ the offers are so low that they're insulted. French says his lawyers initially didn't even bother to call him when they got their offer, which he says is between $100,000 and $200,000. For context, juries awarded payouts between $2 million and nearly $4 million following a Legionnaires outbreak at a downtown Chicago Marriott back in 2012. So French now questions the motives of Democrats like Raoul and Governor J.B. Pritzker after they campaigned on criticizing Republican Governor Bruce Rauner's mishandling of the outbreaks.
Man, I hope it's not just a, you know, election year, you know, campaign topic, because it certainly has taken a couple steps backwards recently.
When Raoul was running for attorney general, he called the state's mishandling of the outbreaks unconscionable. Here he is at a debate in October, weeks before the election.
What we know is that some disturbing things happened at the Quincy Veterans Home that led to deaths. And what we also know is that there was a cover-up of that. And that's very disturbing that came from this administration.
Now that Raoul is in office, a spokeswoman says he continues a criminal investigation into the state's handling of the outbreaks, though no one has been charged. But in the family's negligence cases, Raoul hasn't acknowledged any liability in the initial round of settlement offers. Raoul declined to be interviewed for this story. But a spokeswoman for him says they're in the early stages of negotiations and, quote, "we strongly believe that we will achieve a just and appropriate resolution for the families and the people of the state of Illinois at large."
As a candidate, J.B. Pritzker repeatedly hammered his predecessor for what he called fatal mismanagement of the Quincy Legionnaires crisis. But as governor, he has said that settling the lawsuits is the attorney general's responsibility. When told of the backlash against Raoul's offers, Pritzker's spokeswoman said the governor believes the families deserve justice, but he has no constitutional role in the settlement negotiations. She also pointed to Pritzker's plans for a $230 million rebuild of the Quincy Veterans Home.
The families WBEZ spoke to say they're especially insulted by Attorney General Raoul's low settlement offers because the legislature led them to believe their cases are worth a lot more. At the time the families sued, Illinois law limited the state's liability to just $100,000 per case, the lowest such cap in the country. But following a WBEZ investigation into the state's mishandling of the Quincy Legionnaires outbreaks, lawmakers raised that cap to $2 million. And Raoul, who was then a state senator, even voted yes. So there's room for the families to get more, and they should, says Democratic State Representative Stephanie Kifowit. She chairs the House Veteran Affairs Committee and co-sponsored the bill to raise the liability limit.
The legislative intent that we pass is that we need to honor the veterans, we need to honor the individuals that served our country to a degree that's befitting, and from what I'm hearing, it doesn't seem that they're there yet in the negotiations.
Steve French wants his case resolved. So did his brother, Richard. But earlier this summer, Richard was diagnosed with cancer. He died 2 weeks ago.
He just wanted closure. He wanted to see an end of this horror story that our mother was part of.
Steve says he's turned cynical and he wonders how much longer the story will drag on. I'm Tony Arnold.
And I'm Dave McKinney.
Coming up later, how the solar energy boom is playing out in northern Illinois. This is Sound Ideas.
Another election is coming, and it's time to start getting to know who the candidates are, even if it seems like there are about 1,000 of them.
We've got to make sure that people know that
we have to actually get these things done in a big, bold way.
Because if it is not job one, it won't get done.
Whether you wake up on the right side of the bed, or the left side, or somewhere in the middle, hear opening arguments from presidential hopefuls on Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm GLT Morning Edition host John Norton. Join me weekdays from 4 to 9 a.m. on GLT.
Support for WGLT comes from Westminster Village, a locally owned and operated not-for-profit providing quality retirement living, offering independent living, licensed assistant living, and skilled nursing care on a beautiful campus of more than 40 acres. Details at westminstervillageinc.com. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. More than 4 billion private records were exposed by data breaches in the first half of this year. And colleges are increasingly offering cybersecurity degree programs to prepare students to combat these online threats. IPR's Peter Medlin has more.
Illinois residents have seen their fair share of information compromises. In July, the state received a chunk of the Equifax settlement. These hacks continue to dominate the headlines, and the business of ensuring online privacy is also booming. Right now, there are nearly 3 million unfilled positions in cybersecurity. Illinois Valley Community College recently introduced cybersecurity courses. And it started because local businesses had been approaching them about their security needs.
We brought some banks, we had hospitals and things like that, and they all were in. They said, hey, if you can bring some students through a program that can help them protect our information, we're in.
That was Shane Lang. He's the school's director of workforce development. As of now, IVCC is offering an associate degree and a Security Plus certification. For these new programs, it's key to forge connections with companies in the cybersecurity industry. Software and security are always evolving. Felix Davis knows that. He's a professor in the Information Technology Department at College of DuPage.
There's always going to be a lag in that because things are coming out as we speak, but it gives our program, our content, that capability.
Their program is established. It even has a designation from the NSA and Department of Homeland Security as a center for academic excellence. In addition to those honors, the school makes sure there are instructors in the classroom who are still active in the industry. Nancy McDonald is teaching many of the new cybersecurity classes at Illinois Valley. She says things have changed drastically since she first got her certification.
We were more concerned about incident response, disaster recovery, and now we're trying to take care of a lot of the phishing emails and how the hackers are getting in, the ransomware, and all of that information.
And Davis says now it's not just companies worried about their data, it's everyday people.
There's a term that we should all become familiar with called IoT, Internet of Things, or sometimes you'll hear IOE, Internet of Everything. The fact that there are so many new devices that have networking capability, cars and television and refrigerators.
McDonald says companies should know breaches are not a matter of if, but when. And they even reward hackers who find software issues before they can be exposed. They're called bug bounties.
Even the companies have raised their bug bounty to look for vulnerabilities. Apple just raised theirs to $1 million.
Lang at IVCC even got to witness a bug bounty being captured in person at a conference. It's not quite like the hacking competition scene from David Fincher's The Social Network.
What's going on? We have 10 minutes to get root access to a Python web server, expose its SSL encryption, and then intercept all traffic over its secure port.
They're hacking!
Yes, all behind a fixed firewall emulator, but here's the beauty.
You know I didn't understand anything you just said, right?
I do know that.
So what's the beauty?
Over at Waubonsie Community College, they're still developing their cybersecurity program. It's scheduled to launch next year. Nikisha Stepney is the Dean for Business and Career Technologies. She says she's also been a victim to widespread data breaches.
Irony is very rich. Like sitting at the table talking about the cybersecurity program and getting notification that my data has been sold on the black market.
Stepney says Waubonsie is interested in cybersecurity education, not just for their students, but for everyone in the community. Davis agrees and says, yes, you should probably change your password.
It should change your own behavior. You start to look and realize, you know what? My dog's name is not a good password.
And McDonald says those soft skills, those people skills, are one of the things these programs emphasize with their students to set them apart once they're in the field.
there's not a patch for people to keep them safe. So you can patch your systems all you want, but you can't patch that human emotion of clicking and letting that in.
And it can be a lucrative career choice. Cybersecurity analysts can earn in the six figures. I'm Peter Medlin.
Illinois State University was the first school in Illinois to have a cybersecurity major. This is Sound Ideas. Now from cyber to solar. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker recently signed a measure repealing some restrictions on state efforts to enact green policies. That's encouraged advocates of renewable energy. Brian Haug is the leader of the Solar Energy Division of electrical construction company Continental Electric. He's also president of the Illinois Solar Energy Association. He told IPR's Guy Stevens the Future Energy Jobs Act, or FEJA, gave a big boost to solar projects, large and small in the state, but says more could be done. He cited the solar arrays slated to supply so-called community solar.
That energy is being put right up on the grid, and then you can have subscribers across the state subscribe to a portion of the energy that's being produced from that solar array. That's why it's community solar, because your house or your apartment may not be able to have solar put on it, but you can still benefit from green energy by subscribing to a community solar project. We talk about how much community solar need is out there, demand is out there. There are over 800 projects just in the Commonwealth Edison territory that have gone unfunded with incentives because the demand is so high and the program right now is somewhat restricted on how much money is going into it to continue to develop these types of projects.
I heard from the Illinois Power Agency chief himself.
Yeah.
The aspiration is not matched by the funding.
Sure, sure. The legislation that was passed in 2017 says that the state needs to have 25% of the energy that's being produced in the state from solar power by 2025. And we're not going to get there. We're not on pace to get there. And part of the problem is, you know, it took a while to get the program up and running. And there's been such a built-up demand in solar developers wanting to build these projects that we're going to see a huge boom in solar, which we're seeing right now. It's happening as we speak. But then in a couple years, the money is going to wane a little bit. So we're going to have this dip, which is going to be, you know, very negative on the industry. And then in future years, before we get to 2025, it'll start coming back up. But we're trying to avoid this dip with the Path to 100 legislation that just puts more money into the program to help smooth out that dip. And then, of course, gets us to 25% by 2025, which is the original legislation. The Path to 100 expands that a little bit further down the road. But right now, we're just trying to prevent that boom-bust cycle that Illinois has been so familiar with, the solar coaster, we like to refer to it as.
So what is the mood? On the one hand, you're talking about, oh, this is really happening, this is great, but
yeah,
there's this cliff.
I would call it optimistic excitement. We're all very busy, we're very excited, and I believe, we all believe, that the legislators are all going to be able to work together to come up with a solution that is equitable and amicable to all the players. So I think this fall session will kind of tell the tale.
For those people who are going to like, well, another government thing,
yeah,
another
yeah.
government mandate, what do you say to them about why this is all worthwhile?
Well, it's twofold, you know, clean energy and jobs. We are putting in solutions that are environmentally friendly. They're taking sun rays that are free and turning them into electricity. And it's going to be around for a long time. We're zero emissions. You know, we're not using fossil fuels. And all of that comes together in creating jobs for many, many people. Our company alone has just doubled our size, if not tripled our size in the solar industry for the number of people that we're employing. So it is continuing to grow. So jobs and clean energy, zero emissions. That's what it kind of all boils down to. And we just got to make sure that this ball continues rolling. I mean, look, this isn't a new nascent industry. This is very robust across the country and across the world for that matter. So the Midwest is finally now taking hold and Illinois is leading the way.
That was Brian Haug, president of the Illinois Solar Energy Association. He spoke recently to IPR's Guy Stevens during a ribbon cutting ceremony for a solar array at a private business near Hampshire. This is Sound Ideas. Baseball fans remember the greats of the sport, the Babe Ruths, the Lou Gehrigs, but the players that didn't quite make the Hall of Fame often slip through the cracks of our memories. WGLT's Mary Cullen produced this episode of McHistory, which tells the story of Bloomington native and would-have-been Hall of Fame pitcher Jack Powell.
Katie, Katie was baseball mad, had the fever and had it bad. Just hero for the hometown crew, every Sioux, Katie Blue.
If you talk to people back in the day, this would be the late 19th and into the 20th century, yes, Charles Radbourne was a remarkable pitcher. Yes, Clark Griffith. But perhaps the best pitcher, baseball pitcher, to come out of Bloomington Normal is basically forgotten today, and that's John Joseph Powell, known as Jack Powell.
There are a few pitchers in baseball like Jack Powell. His nerve is unlimited. No situation is too tough for him to tackle. Adam Lovell, Executive Director.
This is Bill Kemp, Librarian with the McLean County Museum of History. Why don't we know much about him? Well, he had the misfortune for a big chunk of his career to play for the St. Louis Browns. The St. Louis Browns is long gone and long struggling American League franchise. They survived today as the Baltimore Orioles. But Powell was an excellent pitcher, very skilled, was in the league a long time, but had a lot of bad luck because he was playing for the Browns for all those years, and the Browns weren't scoring enough runs, and they were dropping the ball too much in the field. So he did not have the support he needed, both on the defensive and offensive side. So if you know anything about baseball statistics, his final career wins and losses are really jaw-dropping. He won 245 games, but lost 254, or nine more than he won. In fact, he holds the Major League Baseball record for the most career wins with a losing record. Yes, the most career wins with a losing record. So even though he won 245 games, which today is an automatic ticket to the Baseball Hall of Fame, he still lost more than he won.
I don't care if I never get back, let me root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame.
He's eighth in career losses all time among major league pitchers. But because he pitched for so long and was so good, he's also 54th in career wins. Which might not seem like a lot, but if you think that thousands upon thousands upon thousands of men have pitched in the major leagues, and Jack Powell is there 54th all time with 245 wins, is pretty remarkable. And in fact, his win total is right behind Bob Gibson, the St. Louis Cardinal great, and C.C. Sabathia, a pitcher of recent vintage, who have 251 each.
Fandom continually hears the praises sung of Mathewson, Walsh, Rucker, Johnson, and the other star twirlers in the two big leagues. These deeds of valor are being continually related. They're great pitchers, and I merit all the praises handed to them. Still, no pitcher in the business is more interesting to me than the veteran Jack Powell.
His first big league season was 1897. He played for the Cleveland Spiders in the National League. The Cleveland Spiders don't exist anymore. Three of his teammates are future Hall of Famers, including Cy Young, arguably the greatest pitcher in Major League Baseball. But at that time, Jack Powell was about as productive and as good as Cy Young. Interestingly, Jack Powell will make his big league debut on May 16, 1897. The problem is there in Cleveland. And that's a Sunday. The city of Cleveland had a rule against superfluous, childish-type entertainments occurring on Sunday, right? The Sabbath. No baseball, in other words. The team decides to hold a game anyways. The city calls the team's bluff, and lo and behold, rookie Jack Powell then is jailed while the team then skedaddles out of town, and Jack Powell is there, the one to face trial. He awaits trial in jail while the team is out of town. In 1899, the owners of the Cleveland Spiders, Frank and Stanley Robinson, create a second team in the National League called the St. Louis Perfectos. And what they do, these two owners of the Cleveland Spiders, they completely gut that roster and they move all the best players to the St. Louis Perfectos, including Cy Young, the future Hall of Famer, and Bloomington's own Jack Powell. So Jack Powell then becomes a St. Louis Perfecto in 1899. The Perfectos have red striping on their uniforms, and fans began to call the Perfectos the Cardinals. And we now know the Perfectos, of course, today as the St. Louis Cardinals.
It is a stout heart, nerves unlimited, and supreme confidence in his own ability that makes Powell the pitcher that he is.
He ends up losing more games than he does win. But he's an excellent pitcher nonetheless. He holds the St. Louis Browns all-time records for games started, innings pitched, strikeouts, of course losses, and he's second in wins all-time. He liked to keep the ball in play, and as we've heard Billy the Boy umpire Evans talk about Jack Powell as a pitcher, he was deceiving. He didn't have overpowering stuff, right? High-speed fastballer, an arcing curveball, but he was wily on the mound, and he knew how to slightly change the trajectory, say, of his curveball or the speed of his fastball, right? And he was tricking batters that way, so he was very deceiving. And often, if he had confidence in his infield and outfield, which sometimes he did not, he wasn't afraid to keep the ball in play. He wasn't afraid to let the batter swing.
Those spectators continually rave because the home players can't hit his offerings. I could hit Powell myself, was the remark heard by one spectator one day as I was leaving the Cleveland grounds. Jack had just finished pitching a brilliant game against the Naps. Powell was so good that day that I couldn't refrain from challenging the fan. If you really think so, I said, come around tomorrow before the game starts, and Powell will bet you 2-1 that you can't even make a foul. I knew Powell well enough to feel sure that he would have made the bet if I had related the circumstances to him. Needless to say, the fan didn't come around for batting practice.
We heard Billy the Boy umpire Evans talk about Jack Powell. That was from a New York Times article from 1912, right at the end of Jack Powell's career. The article was called Successful Twirlers Must Have Something Besides Speed and Curves to Baffle Batsmen. Right. And I think Jack Powell was a successful twirler, and he did indeed have something besides speed and curves to baffle the batsman, as Billy Evans writes. He was an umpire from 1906 to 1927. Yes, he did have that unique nickname, the Boy Umpire, because he started his major league umpiring career in 1906 as a 22-year-old, so the youngest ever to umpire a major league game. He's inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1973. In 1902, Jack Powell from Bloomington, then playing with St. Louis in the National League, was lured to the American League. The American League is known as the junior circuit because it's much younger than the National League. The American League wasn't formed until 1901, so Jack Powell's almost there from the beginnings. He'll play a couple seasons for the St. Louis Browns, but then in 1904, he will play for the New York Highlanders. The newly organized New York Highlanders, they will change their nickname to the Yankees in 1913. The Highlanders will miss the pennant, meaning capturing their league title, by one game. And that will as close as Jack Powell will ever get to the whiff of any sort of championship. Because during the 1905 season, he will be traded to the hapless St. Louis Browns, and then he will finish his career with the St. Louis Browns in 1912.
Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I never get back. Let me root, root, root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. For it's 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're out at the old ball game.
This episode of Mick History was produced by WGLT's Mary Cullen, featuring Bill Kemp and Adam Lovell of the McLean County Museum of History. If you like these deep dives into local history, you should subscribe to the Mick History Podcast. It's available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Eric Stock, Mary Cullen, and student reporter Tiffany Jackson. I'm Ryan Denham. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of the show, so comment on our Facebook page. We're WGLT-FM, or follow us on Twitter or Instagram. We're all at WGLT News. If you like Sound Ideas, you're going to like WGLT's The Leadoff. It's our daily morning podcast. Every new episode has the daily news, the important calendar items, still manages to find a little extra time for our leadoff story. Start your day with WGLT's daily morning podcast, The Leadoff. Learn more at WGLT.org/leadoff. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org. Bloomington-Normal's Public Media.